KALW.
We've driven by 300 sites so far. And so when you get out here and start walking the landscape, there is a lot out here.
Wilderness doesn't necessarily mean land that was always uninhabited.
You know, to say that it's undeveloped, people have been there before us prehistorically. To have a place where nobody's been, that would be interesting, but we don't have that.
Today, it's the next episode of our new series, How Wild. Then, Project 2025 is the conservative blueprint made for a Trump presidency, and analysts say its immigration policy is heavily inspired by one state.
It is partly fixated on California and the so-called sanctuaries it's created for various communities here.
What immigration under Project 2025 looks like. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we start by exploring the concept of capital W wilderness with an excerpt from the second episode of our new podcast, How Wild. The series steps out onto the trail as climate change, increased visitation, and new technologies are testing our definition of wilderness. Here is the host of How Wild, KALW's Marissa Ortega-Welch.
I once heard the historian Phoebe Young say something that stuck with me. That you have to be careful where you start a story, because wherever you assign the beginning, everything before that becomes stasis.
So my spiel, well, we just came up over the mountains, the Black Range Mountains.
It's really pretty. That's why I'm with archaeologist Chris Adams today, driving into the Gila National Forest. Because the Gila is special, and I want to tell you the story of this place, so I'm trying to start back as far as I can.
If you go back to prehistoric times, people have been using this since they were chasing the large megafauna.
As in mammoths and giant sloths, so, you know, a long time ago. We're in the southwest corner of New Mexico, only a few hours' drive from the Mexican border, and we're driving through a beautiful valley, the hillsides dotted with pines. But Chris is seeing something else, something I'm not.
We've driven by 300 sites so far. And so when you get out here and start walking the landscape, there is a lot out here.
When you said we passed 300 sites, what exactly is a site? Is that like the equivalent of a house?
It could be a house. It could be a pueblo room or a pit house, which a small family lived in.
We turn off the highway and follow a dirt road into the national forest, just at the edge of the wilderness boundary. We get out of the car at what looks like just a random rise in the middle of a pine forest.
This would look like an ordinary hill to you. So you're actually walking up what I think is probably maybe upper story, two-story rooms.
Chris has surveyed this site and found evidence to show it was a pueblo, like a village site, from the members' people who lived here starting over 1,000 years ago. And there's still evidence of them if you know how to look.
So this was on the road here.
And what is it?
Pottery.
Oh, what? Look at this.
So that's part of the broken pottery that litters the site when a pot breaks.
If you have an image in your head of Southwestern pottery, you might be thinking of the members' work. They're known for making beautiful bowls with intricate black and red geometric lines, and often an animal in the center, a jackrabbit, a deer, a bird.
And you got a little bit of black decoration, and then this one, you can see the line work. But these are what we look for when we come up upon these sites.
That's incredible. I mean, yeah, I can totally see how this is a puzzle piece of what you were showing me earlier, the white background with the black design. Chris studies the layers upon layers of history here. Ancestors of today's Zuni Pueblo, Acoma Pueblo, and Hopi traveled through this area. The Apache, who also call this place home, were here when settlers, first from Spain, then Mexico, then the U.S., began colonizing the area. Chris found bullet casings in this same spot that he traced back to an Apache battle with U.S. soldiers.
They were fighting for what they believed in. This was their home.
He finds this kind of evidence of history all over the Gila National Forest.
So no different in the wilderness. If you were to go hike into the wilderness and look, it's the same idea, same premise.
He's talking about the official wilderness here, what I call capital W wilderness. What do you picture when you hear the word wilderness? Maybe it's a thick, lush jungle, the remote Arctic, or dramatic mountain peaks. There's wilderness as a concept, but it's also a legal definition. Capital W wilderness areas are parts of public land, like national parks and forests, that are set aside to have this even higher level of protection. They're supposed to be natural, untrammeled, and undeveloped. But obviously, that hasn't always been the case.
You know, to say that it's undeveloped, people have been there before us prehistorically. So to have a place where nobody's been, that would be interesting. But we don't have that.
I've spent the last 20 years hiking in wilderness. And while I love these areas, I've never been comfortable with this implication that they're places that were uninhabited. That's one of the most common critiques of wilderness. It erases the history of the indigenous peoples who were on these lands. Another common critique is that wilderness furthers the idea that humans are separate from nature, just visitors, as opposed to these lands having been managed by people for millennia. So when there are debates, like in Sequoia National Park, about how much to restore wilderness in the face of severe fires or climate change, people draw on these critiques. Why not restore wilderness? People have been managing these places for forever. So I wanted to learn, how did Capital W Wilderness come to be? We have national parks and forests. How is a wilderness different from that? Who decided that we needed to set aside lands where humans are just visitors? This is How Wild, a podcast about wilderness, how it's changing, and what that says about us as humans. Episode 2, Undeveloped.
You know, you think, oh, this is beautiful, and you go around the corner, it's like, oh, this is beautiful, and it just keeps going.
The next day, I'm hiking up a trail with Henry Provincio, who at the time was the Gila National Forest Wilderness District Ranger. Chris and I were talking about history on the scale of hundreds or thousands of years, but Henry and I are hiking to see some more recent history.
Oh, so first crossing, I guess we're going to do it.
We're hiking through this beautiful sandy-bottomed canyon, and we get to a wide, shallow river. And the only way across is through.
You were not kidding about the river crossing. Okay. Yeah, I should have put on my other shoes, but I'll be fine.
I just want to stop and take off my boots, but Henry has to get back for a meeting, and he's totally humoring me by even going on this hike at all.
Let's do it.
Because there's something on this trail I really want to see.
So this trail, how far could we walk on it?
To Canada? you could connect up with the Continental Divide Trail. This will take us completely through the Gila Wilderness if we just continue to follow.
It's beautiful here. The river is carving through a soft red rock canyon. There's juniper trees on the canyon walls above us. It's not necessarily as charismatic as a place like Yosemite or Yellowstone.
We don't get the crowds or somewhere like Yosemite, and thank goodness for that.
But for wilderness nerds like me, it's its own kind of landmark. Finally, we get to this big Flintstone-looking wooden sign marking the entrance to the Gila Wilderness.
So here we are at the Wilderness Boundary.
I've seen a lot of these signs, and they look the same whether you're in California, Alaska, or Georgia. But I wanted to see this sign because it's special.
Gila Wilderness is the first designated wilderness in the world. And that whole concept of wilderness was really born right here.
The concept of Capital W designated wilderness. In 1924, the nation's first wilderness was established here. It sparked the movement that led Congress to pass the Wilderness Act 40 years later. Today, there are over 800 wilderness areas in the U.S. that are protected by law. So how did the idea of Capital W Wilderness come to be?
That is a great question, and I don't think there's a single answer to that.
This is historian Phoebe Young, who wrote the book Camping Grounds about the history of camping in the U.S. She's the one who told me, you have to be careful where you begin a story. So how far back should we begin? Like archaeologist Chris Adams told us, there were waves of people living here going back millennia, from the Membris culture to the Apache and other indigenous peoples. And they didn't view this land as wilderness. It was home.
North America when settlers from Europe arrived, was in fact an intensely peopled place.
Indigenous peoples across the continent had complex social and environmental systems, but they weren't organized around land ownership. So when the first Europeans arrived, who came from a system driven by property rights,
they saw this as open land, even if Indigenous people were using it for sustainable purposes.
And they saw it as their right to colonize the land. First in the East, but then as cities there became crowded, Anglo-Americans were encouraged to go west, settle the open land. This is the era of manifest destiny. The government went into the business of taking land from Indigenous peoples and briefly turning it into public land that could then be sold off to homesteaders or developers. Here in the Gila, as the area was colonized, first by Spain, Mexico, and the U.S., the Apache fought to defend their homeland. Many were killed. By the late 1800s, some of the surviving Apache were captured and imprisoned before being forced to live on a military reservation at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Meanwhile, not all of the land the U.S. took from Indigenous peoples was suitable for farming.
Think Yellowstone, right? This is this incredible landscape of weird geysers and bubbling mud holes, and you can't really imagine planting corn and wheat there.
So some areas get preserved as places of wonder, what become national parks, and some areas were conserved as national forests.
And that's about managing forests essentially as farms, as an agricultural product to sustain forests over the long haul.
To be able to harvest timber. The predecessors of the Fish and Wildlife Service and Bureau of Land Management also started at this time. The national parks and forests became tourist destinations. At first, visitors came on horseback or railroad, which was expensive and required a lot of time. Then something came along to change all that.
Well, the 19-teens and 20s saw an explosion of interest in the national parks and other areas, particularly because of the invention of the automobile. Right, or the Model T, Ford's Model T, which became an affordable automobile for the masses.
The Model T, strong, sturdy, with a will of its own.
Phoebe says that the car made a camping trip to a national park or forest possible for many families. People, and let's be clear, mostly white people, were coming to public lands in droves to hunt and fish and hike and camp. This is the era of the drive-through giant sequoia or redwood. If you haven't seen one, it's just that, a giant tree with a tunnel carved into it so tourists can drive on through.
They think it's kind of a remarkable experience to take their modern car and drive it through an ancient sequoia. That's something that you see postcards, photographs by the hundreds.
All the cars driving through and over tree roots and grasses were starting to kill the forests and meadows.
So what you start to see by the mid-1920s is overcrowding. National parks particularly are ill-prepared for the onslaught of visitors.
That had some environmentalists worried, specifically some employees at the National Forest Service in the Southwest.
They had to figure out a way to both accommodate the visitors and try to make sure that they didn't damage the grass, the meadows, the trees, the views.
One of these concerned Forest Service employees was a guy named Aldo Leopold. If you've heard his name before, it's because he later became famous for writing a book called A Sand County Almanac. But before then, he was just working a forester job here in the Southwest.
I told you where we found this, right? Sitting on top of the ice box in our break room.
So I didn't just come to the Gila to see a wooden sign. I also came to see a box of papers.
So what's in the box? You can find out. There's a link to the full episode at kalw.org/crosscurrents. That was an excerpt from the second episode of How Wild, a series produced by KALW's Marissa Ortega Welch with support from Cal Humanities. It's distributed as a podcast by NPR and will be airing excerpts here on Cross Currents Tuesdays. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Project 2025 is the action plan for Trump's first 180 days in office, put together by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. The 900-page document includes policy goals that many people have expressed concern over, including a national abortion ban, revoking the ability to pass climate change legislation, and deporting the roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country. And we're staying on immigration for our next segment to see how Project 2025's proposed policies would affect California and the Bay Area with our progressive immigration policies. To dig into that, I spoke with Rahim Hosseini. He's race and equity editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's recently reported on what a second Trump term could mean for California. So if we speak specifically in the case of California, what would Project 2025's immigration plan mean for this state with its progressive immigration policies?
The federal government basically owns the role of enforcing immigration law. It has leeway to do a lot of things with or without the state's permission, support, or knowledge. The Project 2025 agenda also calls for things where the state would have some ability to fight back or oppose. For instance, it calls for full cooperation and even deputizing local law enforcement, the National Guard, really maximizing the resources it has to execute this agenda that the Project 2025 architects have envisioned. Now, the state has a law that restricts these very same agencies from sharing certain types of information with the federal government. The legal scholars I spoke to said California would have firm legal standing to say, you can't force our agencies to do something that is against state law. That said, there's two asterisks. Is how would the Supreme Court weigh in if the case reached them? This idea of state authority has held sway with the high court in certain instances. Would it hold sway here? That's kind of an open question. The other thing is Project 2025 finds ways to really arm twist states and local governments. So for instance, sharing information, right? It says that states, if they want to keep basically receiving federal funding, federal grants, even FEMA grants, they basically better get on board with this plan.
How would Project 2025's immigration plan affect San Francisco's status as a sanctuary city and these protections that you're talking about? What really can be done here?
It's also outlined financial disincentives for any sort of sanctuary community, whether it's at the state or local level, through like the grant-making process. Project 2025, not just on immigration, but on many of the issues, reproductive rights, on climate change and environmental protections, it looks at what are the powers of the executive office and the administrative state it runs. And a lot of that is money, right? The various hundreds and thousands of grants that states and local communities apply for from the federal government, it really looks at how to weaponize those grants to assert its agenda here.
So saying in the Bay Area, we have many groups of immigrants, pockets of immigration, and another one is Silicon Valley and the tech immigrants. Are we seeing anything in terms of H-1B visas and people who come through other avenues of immigration? Because here you're talking about the corporations, and you're talking about these huge companies in Silicon Valley, and it's business and it's big tech.
Right.
So does the language start to become different?
In a way, it does. This is where it starts talking about merit-based immigration. And straight from this 900-page policy document, it says, quote, instead of the current system that favors extended family-based and, this is its term, luck of the draw immigration.
So that's like the diversity visa lottery then.
Yeah, it wants to end that entirely. It wants a legislative agenda focused on merit-based immigration. And when it talks about merit-based, it specifically says, quote unquote, best and brightest, right? And what does that mean? That's going to be up to this administration to determine. And what signals do we have about what it means there? Well, we have what the nominee has said on the campaign trail and what he did or attempted to do in his first term, which includes trying to prioritize English speakers and what he said about Central American countries, South American countries, African countries, right? I'm not going to repeat the words he used.
We know them well.
Right. And he spoke very denigrating of some of these countries. He's talked about prioritizing Christianity, people of the Christian faith within the immigration system. And what does that do? Well, that can operate as like a reverse Muslim ban or just a non-Christian ban. I think an important thing to realize about Project 2025, especially now as Trump really tries hard to disavow himself from it, as the public becomes more aware of it and what's in it, it's important to realize that all Project 2025, really, when you get down to it, is the how-to manual. It shares many of the same goals and promises that Trump does. But all it really does is say how he can execute it. For him to say he has nothing to do or no interest in Project 2025, it would sort of be like IKEA selling you a book stand and then trying to disavow the instructions, right? Like he's selling the furniture. The instructions just tell you how to build it. And that's what
Right. It's like a recipe with the, he has all the ingredients already. Are there any new conversations you're hearing about any of this since Kamala Harris is now the Democratic nominee for president?
Well,
anything's changed in that conversation?
I think what's interesting is how she will talk about it. She will say the Project 2025 agenda, and she will trust that the public knows what she's talking about, which is interesting to me because that tells me that this has entered the lexicon enough that it could just be referred to. I've been covering and researching Project 2025 for at least a couple months now. And when I would see what Trump's campaign was saying before I reached out and then when I reached out, and now it's been an evolution. First, it was neutral to positive. Then it was sort of like non-denial, denial. And now it's like this full-throated, get this away from me. So all what this tells me is that this is sort of broken through in a way that the Republican Party really doesn't want to.
Finally, what should immigrant communities be concerned about most right now in this moment?
Trump in his first term tried a lot of things. Some of them were abbreviated, rejected by the courts, didn't come to pass. But they had this effect on immigrant communities who were scared to leave their homes, go to church, go to the grocery store, take their kids to school. And that effect was really real. So are there things to be worried about in this Project 2025 agenda? Absolutely. Yet I'm hesitant to try to underline something that would contribute to the fear in these communities in a way that might paralyze them.
I think the biggest thing, people that I'm hearing from are saying, will our Californian-ness or San Franciscan-ness or Bay Area-ness protect us from what's coming? And I guess the answer is no.
Yeah, I mean, with the agenda that's been outlined, it is partly fixated on California, and Project 2025 almost looks at California as one of its main adversaries in terms of a state. So it outlines specific ways to try to hamstring or attack what the state does, how it does it. And again, a lot of these are through federal funding measures. It's looking at its powers and how to go directly at California and the so-called sanctuaries it's created for various communities here.
That's Rahim Hosseini, race and equity editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. We've got a link to his article on what a Trump term could mean for the Bay Area and California. That's at kalw.org. That interview was produced by Aru Nair. If you want to hear more in-depth coverage of what Project 2025 means for the country, the KALW show Your Call is doing just that. I wanted to ask host Rose Aguilar more about the series they're producing on the project. Hey, Rose.
Hi. So you're doing this whole series on Project 2025. Why and what do you want people to be paying attention to?
Well, we decided to do an entire series on Project 2025 because it would radically change all aspects of U.S. life. So this is an extreme right-wing blueprint. Just a few things that it would do: ban medication abortion, roll back LGBTQ plus rights, expand oil drilling and coal mining. This one's really important because the next president will determine whether or not the United States takes real action on the climate crisis. And we had the Union of Concerned Scientists, Rachel Cletus, on a recent show, and she said Project 2025 would be disastrous for our nation and our climate. So this is an over 900-page document. There's a lot in there. And we decided that it was so important to really go over what it would actually do. It's also important to note, Hana, that even if Trump does not win in November, many aspects of Project 2025 would be implemented at the state level in Republican-controlled states.
Right, right. Well, we will be following. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
That's Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, the KELW show. You can hear their series on Project 2025 on the show weekday mornings at 10 right here on KELW and find it at KELW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.